funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How different will city life be if climate change continues to progress as scientists predict? Urban planners all over the world are trying to devise ways to mitigate the effects of global warming on metropolitan areas, which are already 2 to 10 degrees hotter than less densely populated parts of the world. My guest today has studied this phenomenon closely and is encouraging city leaders to educate themselves and their residents about how urban heat islands will intensify the effects of climate change and to take action now that may help cool things down a bit in the future. Brian Stone Jr. is associate professor in the School of City and Regional Planning at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His new book is called The City and the Coming Climate, Climate Change in the Places We Live. He'll be in town next Tuesday, May 27th, to speak at the Texas Trees Foundation Conference at the Dallas Museum of Art. Brian, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
You opened the book with a horrific story of the 2003 heat wave in the EU, which killed somewhere around 70,000 people. Sometimes we in Texas have a hard time understanding how heat can be so devastating in other parts of the world. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there and why that excessive heat exposure is so dangerous?
Yeah, it was a really an extraordinary event, and one that while many of us read about in the paper and saw on the news while that was unfolding back in 2003. Today, very few people are aware of exactly how deadly that was. You referenced the 70,000 estimate of the individuals who died from that. That is the deadliest natural disaster or weather-related disaster to ever strike a developed region of the world. And so this was a really significant event. And part of what's unique about the event is that it was in mostly in Northern Europe. The epicenter was in France and Italy, and then in a little north of that. And so this is during mainly in August. It was an event that overall went on for about 8 weeks. You had about 2 months of elevated temperatures, and then a few weeks of very hot temperatures. And so when we say very hot temperatures for this part of the world, we mean, getting close to 100 degrees. And so I know in Dallas and in Texas, that doesn't sound like a lot. But many times what we see is that the number of deaths and heat illnesses are associated with how acclimated the population is to heat. And so this is a population that's used to much cooler temperatures. And so it was really an event that was prolonged. And many elderly were particularly vulnerable because families were traveling, extended holiday over there during that time of the year. So it ended up overwhelming the emergency response system and sets an important example for what the type of events we think are becoming more common in all parts of the world.
And one adaptation that we have to heat in say, the South is that we have air conditioning. And this is something that doesn't exist everywhere in the world. And that's also an easy thing to forget.
It's a very easy thing to forget, and we should not take that for granted. I mean, electricity and air conditioning have become our principal adaptive mechanism for dealing with heat. And so whether we realize it or not, we are relying increasingly on air conditioning to protect us from the very real health effects of heat. And so I often point out that the same summer in 2003, we had the most extensive blackout in North American history, which impacted mainly the northeastern U.S., including the New York metropolitan area, and about 50 million people were left without power for 1 to 2 days. It was concurrent with a heat wave, not of the scale that we saw in Europe, but this, had this become a prolonged event, we could have seen very significant impacts associated with the elevated temperatures in these cities. And so over time, we're seeing, mostly due to our antiquated grid, electrical grid, that we're seeing more and more blackouts nationally every year. And so as the climate is getting warmer and as the potential for blackouts is increasing, we may not be as well positioned as we think to deal with these changes.
So before anybody was talking about global warming, scientists were already aware of this phenomenon of urban heat islands. Can you talk about what they are and how they work?
Yeah. So the heat island effect has been observed since the late 19th century, as soon as thermometers became increasingly mobile. And so in particular in London, there were measurements made where temperature observations were made in the center of London, and then an individual actually walked with a thermometer outside of the city, which was easier to do, 120 years ago. It wasn't quite as big. And recorded measurements along the way and could see that temperatures were dropping. And so we know it's very well established that the downtown cores of cities, particularly large cities, are quite a bit warmer, typically in the late afternoon, and it's typically maximized in the warm season in the summer. And you referenced 2 to 10 degrees. That's a good range. It can get as high as 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and it varies greatly by the time of the year and the region. But so we know cities are warmer, and what drives that is typically four basic things. The first is when we lose the natural vegetation through the development process. And so in my region of the world, I'm in Atlanta, we're in a naturally forested region. And so as we lose tree canopy through the development process, that will heat up the environment. Even if we don't bring in the roads and the parking lots and the buildings, we just lose what's known as evapotranspiration, which is just the technical phrase for the process through which trees evaporate water. And in evaporating water, that's a natural cooling mechanism. It uses sunlight in that conversion process from water to water vapor. And that cools off the air, so it's really important. As we lose tree cover or other kind of natural types of vegetation, we lose moisture in cities, and moisture is really important. So that's the first driver. And then we come in typically and we use materials, mineral-based materials like asphalt and concrete and shingle, asphalt shingle. And those materials absorb even more sunlight than the bare soil, and so that further increases temperatures. And then we have a lot of waste heat in cities. We don't often appreciate the extent to which not only are our cars emitting pollution and greenhouse gases, they also emit a lot of heat. So cars and air conditioning systems and industry emit a lot of heat, and so in the typical U.S. city, we think about 25% to 30% of the heat island is driven just by these waste heat emissions. And then lastly, in downtown districts where we have tall buildings, those buildings can trap heat. And so that's a further driver of heat islands in these areas.
So how much of a factor are maybe suburban areas surrounding very densely populated cities that may not be as densely populated but still have development and housing and buildings?
Yeah, that's a really good question and an important question, and one that we've been focused on in my research group for a good bit of time now. What we see, I mean, we notice in a city, again, like Atlanta, and it may be true for Dallas as well, that most of the development in the last 20 or 30 years has not happened in the downtown core at all. Atlanta's downtown looks very similar to how it looked 20 years ago. But we know temperatures are much higher. And so as we're developing around the urban core in the suburbs, we are losing natural vegetation and we're increasing the amount of paving. And so those areas are heating up, but a lot of that heat is being drawn downtown. And so we know that when we create surface hotspots, that light creates density changes in the air mass, and you get rising air, and that can draw in air from around the city, and so we can think of it kind of as a thermal vortex, if you will. But we draw in a lot of that heat energy to the downtown district, even if the downtown district isn't changing, and so the suburbs have a big impact not only on what's happening in the suburbs, but the urban core as well.
So very few established cities, maybe Detroit's an exception to this, would be prepared to raise a lot of existing development and restore, vegetation.
Right.
But can you talk about how green belts might still be used to mitigate some of these effects?
Yeah, I mean, green belts, increasing green cover, whatever the natural land cover is, forest cover, it can be prairie, around the city, is a really useful strategy for cooling down the places where people are living and also the downtown core. And so we have a couple strategies we recommend. Vegetation in any form is really useful to cooling down cities. And we know that it can actually have a powerful effect. We can see this if you simply, walk from a downtown block into a park or small park space. you can feel the temperature drop, particularly in shaded areas. So that's the common experience for folks that they can relate to. But we know if we do this extensively around urban areas, we can cool off the region very effectively. And so there is a study now many years ago in Los Angeles that looked at a combination of planting trees throughout the region, and the L.A. Basin is obviously a very large region. But if you planted literally millions of trees around this region, and then you use what we call cool materials, more highly reflective roofing materials and paving materials, you could almost entirely eliminate the region's heat island. And so it's really, in one sense, it's very empowering in that cities have a lot of control over their own climate fates, assuming they can work effectively with their regions to adopt these cooler development practices.
There are questions, certainly we're seeing it playing out in Southern California right now, about supplemental irrigation that might be required in regions that already are really strained for water.
Yeah, and that's a really important issue. In my region of the world, we have sufficient natural rainfall to support a lot of tree planting and green roofs and other kind of vegetative strategies. What I like to recommend is that cities need to better approximate the landscapes of their regions. And so if you are, in a region of the world like Southern California or parts of Arizona where the natural vegetation is kind of a prairie grass or a shrubland, that is probably the type of vegetation that you're best positioned to reincorporate into your developed areas. We're not going to be able to cool down, Phoenix to match the temperatures we see in other parts of the country just because that's the landscape that the city finds itself in. We certainly don't want to be exacerbating other environmental issues like water availability, and so we have to be sensitive to that in the strategies that we choose to deal with heat islands.
It is stunning when you go to a city like Phoenix, and in certain neighborhoods, rather than xeriscaping, there are these emerald green lawns, which clearly would not grow there naturally. It would seem that making a change to more closely approximate the natural landscape would require some policy change in addition to maybe public education.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and so obviously, those emerald green lawn areas are very effective in cooling the region, but that comes at a substantial cost. It's obviously not a feasible strategy for all of the city. And so we see some innovative programs around the country to incorporate more green space into cities. One of these is known technically as it's called a green area ratio. It's a zoning tool. And what it says, it sets a standard for every land lot, whether it be a commercial lot or a residential lot or institutional, and it says we think we can achieve a 50% green cover. It would vary based on where we are in the country, but maybe a 40 or 50% green cover for every residential parcel. And so when it comes to redeveloping the parcel or developing anew, that standard needs to be met, and there's an entire menu of strategies to meet that minimum green cover standard. If your listeners are familiar with the LEED program for buildings, it's like a LEED program for landscaping. And that really gets the notion of climate-responsive design into the DNA of how cities develop. And I think ultimately that's probably the most effective way to bring in vegetation extensively throughout a region.
Brian Stone, Jr. is my guest. He's associate professor in the School of City and Regional Planning at the Georgia Institute of Technology and author of the new book, The City and the Coming Climate, Climate Change in the Places We Live. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Boot Camp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Brian Stone, Jr., Associate Professor in the School of City and Regional Planning at the Georgia Institute of Technology and author of The City and the Coming Climate, Climate Change in the Places We Live. Brian Stone, Jr. will be in town at the Texas Trees Foundation's conference taking place May 27th at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation now, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, Brian, let's talk about roofing and some of the solutions that might make a difference in densely populated areas, starting with something as simple as changing the color that we're using on our roofs.
Yeah, this is a very simple strategy, and it's a relatively low cost strategy, depending on how it's carried out. In my part of the country, we have a particular affinity for very darkly hued roofing materials, typically a black asphalt shingle. That makes very little sense in a relatively warm part of the country. It appears to be just a legacy of Northern European immigration to the United States, and so there's no functional reason to have such a dark roof in a warm climate, and so that obviously absorbs a lot of sunlight. It warms up the roof. It warms up the building. Our air conditioning system has to work harder. We spend more money. It really is not a very good strategy on a number of levels, and so we can engineer roofing shingle in obviously a range of colors, but also the material itself can be made to be more reflective of that incoming solar energy. This is the easiest applications, obviously, on commercial roofs. Large warehouses already tend to use very light roofing materials because it saves a lot of money on cooling. Transitioning that to the residential part of the market is a slower process, but we have examples around the country where we have incentives and requirements. Austin, Texas is a national leader as far as having a minimum reflectivity standard for all roofing shingle, and more cities are starting to follow that model.
And how different do those roofs look? I mean, I can understand in a commercial application where you've got a flat roof and nobody sees it unless they go up there, it's not a big deal. Some people are very particular about what their house looks like from the street.
Yeah, and that's understandable. And so we're fortunate in that the industry has advanced quite a bit. And now you can get a roofing material, a shingle material, in really a medium to dark gray, a full palette of colors. Some are quite not terribly dark, but moderately dark. And they are highly reflective. They can be engineered independent of color. Technically, they have a lower, they modify the emissivity. And so that enables the roofing shingle to basically absorb less energy from the sun. And so those materials today, the darker slate-like roofing materials, the cool materials, cost a bit more than the traditional shingles. But if you have a time period over which you're willing to absorb those costs and offset them with reduced energy costs, then that can make a lot of sense.
And how about green roofs? Are these mostly practical for new construction, or is it easier than I might imagine to retrofit existing buildings?
Again, it depends on the building. For commercial buildings, it's all going to depend on the structural components of the roof and whether it can bear that weight. There are different models of green roofs. There are intensive green roofs that tend to have deeper soils and can have larger types of vegetation. And then there are extensive green roofs, which tend to be have more shallow soil profiles and tend to be grass-like species or sedum, more drought-tolerant types of plants. You can retrofit buildings usually quite easily, again, in the low-pitched roof style of development. For the pitched residential roofs, that's harder to do. It certainly is feasible, and there are lots of examples from other parts of the world. Germany is a global leader in green roofs, and there's every style of house there has vegetation on it. One of the aspects that's not appreciated about green roofs is that they certainly are more expensive to install initially, but they protect the roofing membrane for a much longer period of time. And so the time to which you would need to re-roof your house can be extended greatly and again, help offset that initial cost of the green roof.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Philip in Dallas. Hello, Philip.
Hi, Chris. Love the show and the topic. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question for your guest. I've read about, of course, I can't remember the technical name of it right now, but there's an architect in Italy, in Milan, who has designed very dense and very tall apartment buildings that actually incorporate trees and dense vegetation into the design of the building itself. I wondered if your guest had any thoughts or comments on, instead of just relegating green spaces to, you know, parks and things outside of the apartment building or even, you know, the office building, but incorporating them more integrally, into the building itself. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question. The most well-known architect who's working with, it goes by a number of names, bio walls, green walls, vertical gardens, is Patrick Blanc, who's, I believe he's French. And he has designed, and if you see an image of this, and if you're curious, I encourage you to look online and just Google or search for, vertical garden or green wall. Really just beautiful facades of buildings, and it almost looks like it's difficult to believe that you can grow vegetation in this fashion. But the way this process works is they have essentially a plastic lattice that they span the building facade with, and then the plants grow directly into this plastic lattice, and they're constantly streaming water down that has a nutrient content to it. And they recycle the water, and that enables the vegetation to grow. You can adapt this to any building facade. It's quite feasible. It's, at this point, it's not a very inexpensive proposition to do this. It does require a fair amount of water usage as well, but it does point to the potential, in particularly environments that receive more precipitation annually, to creatively incorporate green space, particularly on some of the hottest surfaces we find in cities. And so that's one of the strategies that these green area ratio policies recognize and allow as a way to incorporate green space into parcels where you don't have a lot of open landscape.
What about road and street surfaces? Anybody who has ever tried to cross a street in Texas, or I would venture to say also in Georgia, in flip-flops in the middle of July realizes how very, very hot asphalt gets.
Yeah.
Can you talk about alternatives and ways that we can actually build cooler streets?
Yeah, there's a lot of innovative thinking in terms of roadways today. The most basic strategy is like the cool roofs, is you can increase the surface reflectivity. You can do this with various coating materials. There are high albedo asphalts we can use directly that are just lighter aggregates, but we can resurface, or we can just apply a coating, a highly reflective coating to roadways and parking lots. The one caveat to doing that is we don't want our roadways to be extremely reflective, because that will create glare problems.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, when you're operating a vehicle, that could be dangerous. We're also ultimately just reflecting that solar energy back into buildings and pedestrians. And so in a really high-density area, having a very high reflective surface material may not be an ideal strategy. But concrete roadways tend to be about the optimal reflectivity that you want for those surfaces, and so it doesn't require high-tech solutions at all. The only other innovation I might note is there's lots of discussion about how we can harness that heat energy that's in the roadways. Roadways account for a very large percentage of downtown districts. In some cases, roads and parking lots are more than half of all the land in a downtown area. And so if we could either run pipes through those streets to increase the temperature, run water or some kind of fluid through those pipes and increase the temperature or capture some of that heat energy to ultimately drive a turbine and create electricity, that's one creative solution. There's another group that's trying to use solar panels as paving material to again, harness that energy. And those would have some cooling benefits as well. And so there's lots of ongoing activity thinking about how to use all this space that right now is quite costly to us in terms of climate.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Rich in Irving. Hello, Rich. Rich, are you with us? Okay, we will move on and speak with Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi, another great show.
Thank you.
I have a quick question. You know, we're here in a native black land prairie here in North Texas, and we have native grasses that are adapted to the drought and drier conditions. But I'm wondering whether or not you've ever looked into the culture of mowing lawns and the affection for short grasses, how that's affected people's decisions and in a city. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, great question. My research group hasn't specifically looked at the issue of cultural preferences for mowing grass and lawn grass, but we know just based on the physics that the denser the vegetation, the more natural cooling you're going to get. And so we did have in some of my own work years ago, we were looking at how different green spaces around the city of Atlanta performed in terms of their temperature. And we found golf courses in many instances were quite hot. And so on the one hand, many golf courses will be irrigated daily. And so that provides a lot of moisture, and that's a natural cooling benefit. But in the late afternoon, because the grass is so short, you have a lot of exposed soil there. And that, in some cases, that was exhibiting temperatures similar to concrete. And so, you know, the longer the stem on the grass, in general, the more cooling you're going to get. And so if we can encourage not mowing that down just as short as possible, I think there's some benefits there undoubtedly.
Back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Rich in Irving. Hey, Rich.
Hi. Sorry about that earlier call.
It's okay.
I dropped the phone. Great timely topic you have. And what I would like to find out, first of all, is with all the highways that Texas has, why do we not plant trees in between the lanes of traffic, the wide areas of grass? It's just grass, as far as I can see. Why would we not plant trees in its place? And my second point I wanted to make was, for every tree that we tear to destroy when we build, which is not going to stop anytime soon, every tree that has at least 5 years of growth should be replaced by five more trees. Does that not make a lot of sense?
What do you think, Brian?
I think it makes a great deal of sense. As far as the highway median question, I don't know technically why grass is favored over trees. I'm sure it has to relate to, one, it's a lot cheaper, and two, the trees itself probably create somewhat of a hazard for the moving traffic if there's an accident. But I think in most situations having trees there would provide a cooling benefit, and it is a lot of land that's available for some kind of a strategy. The second part of your question, Chris, remind me, I lost my train of thought he'd asked the second part of his question was
for every tree that had 5 years
right,
of growth,
that's right.
Put five more back.
So the policies on tree protection vary greatly around the country, and I don't profess to know how tree protection works in Dallas. In Atlanta, we have a tree ordinance that does require you to replace inch for inch trees that are lost. And so the point that when we cut down mature trees, we do lose a lot of value in those trees. It takes obviously a long time to grow a mature tree. And so to simply replace, you know, a large mature tree with a 2 or 3 inch immature tree, you're losing lots of values in terms of both stormwater management and also your cooling benefits, not to mention just basic aesthetics. And so often you have a one-for-one. If you lose a tree, you replace it with a tree. The more effective policies require you to replace inch for inch. And so it's a very important point that he raised.
So many people have heard that the rate of global warming is accelerating. We've talked in this hour about the fact that cities tend to be warmer than other parts of the world that are less developed. Is there a multiplier effect? Are cities now warming faster than other areas?
Yeah, and that's a really key question that we've been focused on in my research group. so much of the climate change discussion is happening at the global scale, and there are good reasons for that. There are lots of kind of global systems that are impacted that have very serious implications for the rest of the planet, like the polar regions we've been hearing about, the loss of the ice shelves in the western Antarctic region recently. But cities, one would believe cities are not only hotter than what's around them, but perhaps warming more rapidly over time. And so we wanted to answer that question. And so we've looked at the 50 largest cities in the United States, including Dallas, and how rapidly these cities are warming relative to what's around them. And what we find is that the typical large city in the United States is warming at a rate that's about 50% greater than that of what's around it, and that's also 50% greater than the planet as a whole. And then there's some cities in the United States that actually their heat islands are not growing. Cities like Houston, perhaps surprisingly, but cities that are close to coastal areas that have a strong sea breeze effect, a lot of that heat gets distributed well between the suburbs and the city itself and even rural areas. And so the heat island is there, but it's not growing very rapidly over time. If we remove those cities from our data set, which tends to be, I think the number is about 20% of the cities in our data set, the rate of growth of warming in cities is about double that of the planet as a whole. And so the average large U.S. city is warming at double the rate of the planet. And that really is accelerating the time to which we need to be adapting to some significant heat challenges that are really already upon us.
Brian Stone, Jr. is Associate Professor in the School of City and Regional Planning at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and he's author of the new book, The City and the Coming Climate, Climate Change in the Places We Live. He'll be in town next Tuesday, May 27th, to speak at the Texas Trees Foundation Conference at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation now, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can email the show at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Brian Stone, Jr. of the Georgia Institute of Technology about his new book, The City and the Coming Climate, Climate Change in the Places We Live. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. And that's where we hear on Twitter from George, who says, if, as I was taught in physics, heat rises, then why don't the elevated heat index temperatures dissipate?
Well, the heat does rise, and it's part of what's driving that buoyant exchange is additional heat being emitted from the surface. And so, once the sun sets in the evening, and you have that constant input of solar energy is dissipating, then you will start to see these surfaces cool. But during the day, that heat is just simply being displaced by more heat. And so that obviously leads to rising temperature over the course of the day, which is further magnified in the late afternoon when we have our second period of traffic, which is emitting lots of waste heat, and then air conditioning systems in the summer in a place like Dallas tend to be working very hard in the late afternoon. So we don't have just that solar input. We also have the human waste heat input that's contributing to high temperatures in cities.
So as we look at ways to deal with all of this, Brian, you stress that we need to target both the causes of climate change and the effects equally. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Well, there are causes of climate change that are occurring at different scales. And so we know in cities we've got cities are warming because of what's happening globally. We know the planet is warming. We can measure that directly. It's really not anything we can debate as far as whether the planet is warming over the last several decades. We clearly see that. And so the warming that's happening in terms of cities, part of that is from that global process. What we find is for these largest cities in the United States, most of the temperature increase, by which I mean maybe 60%-ish, has been from the urban heat-on effect. And so we have both of these processes that are driving warming in cities. It's very hard, it's actually impossible for a city to slow the rate that it's warming from reducing greenhouse gases. We need to be doing that in general to address the larger issue. But simply reducing greenhouse gases in cities will not cool down the city anytime soon. But cities really can focus on their land use and the design of their neighborhoods and downtown districts. And so thinking about, I try to focus on the effects of climate change at the scale at which people live and engage with the world in their own cities and neighborhoods, and thinking about the actions that they can take at that scale to cool down their own environments and have benefits in terms of quality of life and have benefits in terms of their own energy costs.
So all of those benefits sound desirable if occasionally expensive. Can you talk about where pushback tends to come from? Is it from the business community that says these kinds of new regulations make it harder for us to not only do our business but to be competitive with, say, neighboring cities that might not make the same decisions?
Yeah, there's always a reluctance to embrace change and thinking about a particular development in different ways. I think a truism of this process is nothing new, is that when we invest in preserving some of our green infrastructure, like in the case of my city, our tree canopy, that tends to yield dividends to both the environment and the development community. We know that from a study nationally that just having trees that are visible on residential lots can raise property values by quite a bit. Having a single large tree in your front yard has been found to increase your property values by about 1%. And so that can add up, and that's a real benefit. And so developers, I think, increasingly find that if they can modify their practices to save trees and vegetation, and particularly even if they incur some additional upfront costs, the value of that property is much greater over time. And it's much greater to the city that has less to invest in terms of dealing with stormwater and ultimately in dealing with these issues associated with heat.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Pete on the line now in Arlington. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Great subject and great ideas from your guest. But every time I hear these kinds of discussions and presentations, it occurs to me that what your guest is suggesting is a number of very innovative and creative technical approaches to mitigating the effect of climate change. He just said we've ultimately got to stop spewing so many greenhouse gases, and that's right. And my point is, if he cares to comment, until the population of this planet comes to view this planet as spaceship Earth, which is what it was called in the very early days of the environmental movement, then nothing's ever going to get done. Astronauts who go up in spaceships are very, very, very good stewards by necessity of their environment. Spaceship Earth needs people who take that same stewardship. Thank you for taking my question, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I agree entirely with the caller that I think we're coming to terms increasingly with how fragile our environment is. We know the Earth has been very resilient to a lot of the impacts that we have imposed upon it. But what we're seeing now is of a scale in terms of global change that is unprecedented. And so what I try to communicate in talking about climate change is to move away from a discussion of what's happening in a future time period. We focus a lot on the end of the 21st century when we talk about our climate projections. We're often talking about very remote and foreign environments like the North Pole. Climate change is happening in the places where we all live, particularly in cities. These are some of the most rapidly warming places on the planet. And so I really try to focus on what are the actions we can take to deal with climate change in the places we live, and what are the range of benefits? Because it's not just about, you know, trying to cool the planet so our kids have a livable environment. Most of these strategies that we're talking about are consistent with creating more sustainable communities that have a higher quality of life. And so as we've been investing in green space in Atlanta, we're one of the cities that has the lowest area of public parks per person. And so we've been doing that and creating bike paths and new parks, and that all has a climate benefit for us. And that's essentially secondary to why we're investing in it. It's just improving quality of life. And so almost all of these strategies really have benefits for us today.
How are local and regional leaders collaborating with one another to sort of share what has worked in their areas and maybe what they have unsuccessfully tried to get done?
Yeah, there we have just a handful of models for thinking about climate adaptation, particularly in terms of heat in cities. The notion for a city mayor or a policymaker or a planner that we can actually modify temperatures through the design of the city is a somewhat new idea. We have well-developed systems that respond to emergencies like heat waves, but we don't have a capacity today to think about long-term design strategies that will cool down the city. And so today we don't have, I don't know of any city that has what I would call a comprehensive heat management plan. Louisville, Kentucky, interestingly, is developing what is probably the first real heat management plan in the nation right now. And so we have a few models. I would point to Louisville for taking these steps, and they are actively trying to determine the extent of their tree canopy and what the benefits would be of growing that canopy and of increasing cool materials. There are some programs in Chicago, which ever since a very extreme heat wave there in the mid-1990s, have been very aware of how the design of the city can intensify heat waves, and so they've adopted a number of programs. And then, again, cities like where we may not expect to see it, Austin, Texas, is really a national leader in thinking about reflective materials. And now Los Angeles and New York are undertaking campaigns to plant a million trees. And so we have a lot of really impressive individual programs out there, but I'd say having a comprehensive heat management plan is still a new idea for cities today.
Let's go next on the phone to Abby in Dallas. Hi, Abby.
Hi. I really like the show. Thanks for taking my question. My question is, why is solar energy not being harnessed as much as we would like it to be? Like, for example, why are we not seeing them on the rooftops of our homes or in the big buildings?
Well, it's a great question. It's a question that has an interesting relationship to heat islands. I'll address just the solar kind of dissemination question first. And so we know that the cost of solar has come down dramatically over just the last few years. I'm one of those unlucky individuals that installed solar panels on his roof about 4 years ago. Today, if I did it, it would cost at least half as much. And so the reduction in the cost of solar is quite dramatic. I think for many communities, if you don't have a utility that is actively promoting solar, it still feels like an exotic technology that's out of reach. And I think that's probably not true anywhere in the U.S. There are solar installers all over the U.S. The cost is very reasonable. There are tax credits at the federal level and in many cases at the state level that enable the upfront cost to be offset. And these systems perform very well. It's a very well-established technology. So I think we're going to see more and more solar on people's rooftops. So that's an exciting prospect, but I would agree that it's we're kind of slow to undertake that challenge because it just seems like it's a little bit out of reach. The one point I would note as far as solar panels and heat mitigation is that the solar panels themselves on a rooftop do not do much to either heat up the roof or cool it down. The amount of actual energy that the solar panel, the amount of solar energy that's used by the solar panel is actually quite small. Solar panels are still pretty inefficient, and so there's a lot of waste heat that's generated there. It would have been converted to waste heat anyway by the roof itself. If you're putting solar panels over a very bright, cool roof, you may actually increase temperatures a little bit. But I don't think there's much of a conflict between solar panels on our house and dealing with heat island issues.
How accurately, Brian, can we predict how hot it might be in any given city, say, a decade or two decades from now? And what can we do in this moment to try to mitigate that?
Well, I think really for the first time, we can develop a reasonable estimate of how hot it will be at the scale of a city or a metropolitan region. We have these global scale climate models that have been in use for several decades now. The precision of those models in terms of reproducing historical temperatures has improved greatly, but the resolution of those models is too coarse to even see what's happening at the city level. And so we have an entire new class of models that are regional climate models, and these can now perform very well at the scale of cities. And so we've just wrapped up a study looking at three cities. We looked at Atlanta and Philadelphia and Phoenix, and we were asking the question, well, if these cities were to invest in lots of tree planting where it's appropriate, in Phoenix we were looking at increasing the natural, mostly shrubland conditions. And if they were to invest in cool materials, how much could that cool the city down by the mid-century, say 2050, and how many lives would that save? And we actually were able to develop very high-resolution projections of temperature. So essentially at the neighborhood level, we could get a sense of what temperature would look like, air temperature, several decades in the future. And then we could see how our various heat mitigation strategies would reduce temperatures. And we found these strategies to be very effective. And even more so, we were able to target and show specifically in various neighborhoods how many additional heat-related deaths we thought we would see and how many of those deaths could be offset through these strategies. And we found these strategies to be very effective. I'll share just one finding briefly with you. In Atlanta, we were able to fully offset the increase in heat deaths over that period of time. And so these strategies appear to be very effective, but they do require aggressive action by cities now, because it takes a long time to increase tree canopy, and it certainly will take a long time or probably several decades to increase the amount of cool materials around the city.
Brian Stone, Jr. is Associate Professor in the School of City and Regional Planning at the Georgia Institute of Technology and author of the book The City and the Coming Climate, Climate Change in the Places We Live. He'll be in town next Tuesday, May 27th, for the Texas Trees Foundation Conference. Brian, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Hey, Chris, a total pleasure. I appreciate all the questions.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help today on the phones from Katie Daniel. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.